Chapter 112. That rational creatures are governed for their own sake, and other creatures, as directed to them. In the first place, then, the very condition of the rational creature, in that it has dominion over its actions, requires that the care of providence should be bestowed on it for its own sake, whereas the condition of other things that have not dominion over their actions shows that they are cared for, not for their own sake, but as being directed to other things, because that which acts only when moved by another, is like an instrument, whereas that which acts by itself, is like a principal agent. Now an instrument is required, not for its own sake, but that the principal agent may use it. Hence whatever is done for the care of the instruments must be referred to the principal agent as its end, whereas any such action directed to the principal agent as such, either by the agent itself or by another, is for the sake of the same principal agent. Accordingly, intellectual creatures are ruled by God, as though he cared for them for their own sake, while other creatures are ruled as being directed to rational creatures. Again, that which has dominion over its own act, is free in its action, because he is free who is cause of himself, whereas that which by some kind of necessity is moved by another to act, is subject to slavery. Therefore every other creature is naturally under slavery, the intellectual nature alone is free. Now, in every government provision is made for the free for their own sake, but for slaves that they may be useful to the free. Accordingly divine providence makes provision for the intellectual creature for its own sake, but for other creatures for the sake of the intellectual creature. Moreover, whenever certain things are directed to a certain end, if any of them are unable of themselves to attain to the end, they must needs be directed to those that attain to the end, which are directed to the end for their own sake. Thus the end of the army is victory, which the soldiers obtain by their own action in fighting, and they alone in the army are acquired for their own sake, whereas all others, to whom other duties are assigned, such as the care of horses, the preparing of arms, are acquisite for the sake of the soldiers of the army. Now, it is clear from what has been said, that God is the last end of the universe, whom the intellectual nature alone obtains in himself, namely by knowing and loving him, as was proved above. Therefore the intellectual nature alone is requisite for its own sake in the universe, and all others for its sake. Further, in every whole, the principal parts are requisite on their own account for the completion of the whole, while others are acquired for the preservation or betterment of the former. Now, of all the parts of the universe, intellectual creatures hold the highest place, because they approach nearest to the divine likeness. Therefore divine providence provides for the intellectual nature for its own sake, and for all others for its sake. Besides, it is clear that all the parts are directed to the perfection of the whole, since the whole is not on account of the parts, but the parts on account of the whole. Now, intellectual natures are more akin to the whole than other natures, because, in a sense, the intellectual substance is all things, inasmuch as by its intellect it is able to comprehend all things, whereas every other substance has only a particular participation of being. Consequently God cares for other things for the sake of intellectual substances. Besides, whatever happens to a thing in the course of nature happens to it naturally. Now, we see that in the course of nature the intellectual substance uses all others for its own sake, either for the perfection of the intellect, which sees the truth in them as in a mirror, or for the execution of its power and development of its knowledge, in the same way as a craftsman develops the conception of his art in corporeal matter, or again to sustain the body that is united to an intellectual soul, as is the case in man. It is clear, therefore, that God cares for all things for the sake of intellectual substances. Moreover, if a man seeks something for its own sake, he seeks it always, because what is per se, is always, whereas if he seek a thing on account of something else, he does not of necessity seek it always but only in reference to that for the sake of which he seeks it. Now, as we proved above, things derive their being from the divine will. Therefore whatever is always is willed by God for its own sake, and what is not always is willed by God, not for its own sake, But for another's, now, intellectual substances approach nearest to being always, since they are incorruptible. They are, moreover, unchangeable, except in their choice. Therefore intellectual substances are governed for their own sake, as it were, and others for the sake of intellectual substances. The fact that all the parts of the universe are directed to the perfection of the whole is not in contradiction with the foregoing conclusion, since all the parts are directed to the perfection of the whole, insofar as one part serves another. Thus in the human body it is clear that the lungs belong to the body's perfection, in that they serve the heart, wherefore there is no contradiction in the lungs being for the sake of the heart, and for the sake of the whole animal. In like manner that other natures are on account of the intellectual is not contrary to their being for the perfection of the universe, for without the things required for the perfection of the intellectual substance, the universe would not be complete. Nor again does the fact that individuals are for the sake of the species militate against what has been said, because through being directed to their species, they are directed also to the intellectual nature. For a corruptible thing is directed to man, not on account of only one individual man, but on account of the whole human species. Yet a corruptible thing could not serve the whole human species, except as regards its own entire species. Hence the order whereby corruptible things are directed to man requires that individuals be directed to the species. When we assert that intellectual substances are directed by divine providence for their own sake, we do not mean that they are not also referred to God and for the perfection of the universe. Accordingly, they are said to be provided for on their own account, and others on account of them, because the goods bestowed on them by divine providence are not given them for another's profit, whereas those bestowed on others are in the divine plan intended for the use of intellectual substances. Hence it is said, lest thou see the sun and the moon and the other stars, and being deceived by error, thou adore and serve them, which the Lord thy God created for the service of all the nations that are under heaven. And Psalms 8:8, thou hast subjected all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, moreover, the beasts also of the field. And thou, being master of power, judgest with tranquility, and with great favor disposest of us. Hereby is refuted the error of those who said it is sinful for a man to kill dumb animals, for by divine providence they are intended for man's use in the natural order. Hence it is no wrong for man to make use of them, either by killing or in any other way whatever. For this reason the Lord said to Noah, as the green herbs I have delivered all flesh to you. And if any passages of Holy Writ seem to forbid us to be cruel to dumb animals, for instance to kill a bird with its young, this is either to remove man's thoughts from being cruel to other men, and lest through being cruel to animals one become cruel to human beings, or because injury to an animal leads to the temporal hurt of man, either of the doer of the deed, or of another, or on account of some signification. Thus the apostle expounds the prohibition against muzzling the ox that treadeth the corn. Chapter 113. That the rational creature is directed to its action by God, not only in its relation to the species, but also in its relation to the individual. Hence it is clear that the rational creature alone is directed to its actions by God, with due regard not only to the species, but also to the individual. For, seemingly, everything is on account of its operation, since operation is the ultimate perfection of a thing. Wherefore each thing is directed to its action by God, according as it stands under divine providence. Now, the rational creature stands under divine providence as being governed and cared for, on its own account, and not, as other corruptible creatures, on account of the species only, because the individual that is governed only for the sake of the species is not governed for its own sake, whereas the rational creature is governed for its own sake, as we have made clear. Accordingly, rational creatures alone are directed by God to their actions for the sake, not only of the species, but also of the individual. Besides, things that are directed in their actions only so far as these referred to the species have not the power to act or not to act, since whatever results from the species is common and natural to all the individuals contained in the species. and we have no choice about natural things. Hence, if man were directed in his actions in reference only to the demands of the species, he would not have the power to act, or not to act, and he would have to follow the natural inclination common to the whole species, as is the case with all irrational creatures. It is therefore clear that rational creatures are directed in their actions, with regard not only to the species, but also to the individual. Moreover, as we proved above, divine providence extends to every single thing, even the least. Therefore, whatever things have actions outside the inclination of nature, must needs in such actions receive from divine providence a direction besides that which regards the species. Now, many actions are apparent in the rational creature, for which the inclination of the species is not sufficient, and a sign of this is that they are not the same in all, but differ in different subjects. Therefore, the rational creature must needs be directed to its actions by God, with reference not only to the species, but also to the individual. Again, God provides for every nature according to its capacity, for he made each creature such that he knew it to be adapted to obtain its end through being governed by him. Now, the rational creature alone is capable of being directed to its actions, in respect not only of the species but also of the individual, because it has intellect and reason, so as to be able to perceive the different ways in which a certain thing is good or evil in relation to various persons, times, and places. Therefore, the rational creature alone is directed by God to its actions, in respect not only of the species but also of the individual. Besides, the rational creature is subject to divine providence in such a way, that not only is it governed thereby, but is able to know something of the nature of providence, so that it is capable of providence and government in respect of others. This is not the case with other creatures, for they only participate in providence by being subject to it. Now, through being capable of providence, a man can direct and govern his own actions also. Therefore, the rational creature participates in divine providence not only in being governed, but also in governing, for it governs itself in its own actions, and other things too. Now, every lower providence is subject to divine providence as supreme. Therefore, the government of a rational creature's acts, as personal acts, belongs to divine providence. Again, the personal acts of a rational creature are properly those that proceed from the rational soul. Now, the rational soul is capable of perpetuity, not only in respect of the species, like other creatures, but also in respect of the individual. Therefore, the actions of the rational creature are directed by divine providence, not only in the point of their belonging to the species, but also inasmuch as they are personal. Hence it is that, though all things are subject to divine providence, yet Holy Writ ascribes the care of men to it in a special manner, according to Psalms 8. 5. What is man that thou art mindful of him? And 1 Corinthians 9. 9. Doth God take care of oxen? These things are said because God watches over man's actions not only as belonging to the species, but also as personal acts. Chapter 114. That laws are given by God to man. It is evident from this that it was necessary for man to receive laws from God, for, as we have shown, just as the acts of irrational creatures are directed by God, inasmuch as they belong to the species, so are man's actions directed by God, inasmuch as they belong to the individual. Now, in so far as they are actions belonging to the species, actions of irrational creatures are directed by God by a certain natural inclination, which is consequent to the specific nature. Therefore, in addition to this, something must be given to man whereby he is directed in his personal actions. And this is what we call law. Again, the rational creature, as stated above, is subject to divine providence, in such a way as to participate in a certain likeness of divine providence, inasmuch as it is able to govern itself in its own actions, and other things also. Now, that by which the actions of people are governed is a law. Therefore, it was reasonable that a law should be given to man by God. Besides, since a law is nothing else than a reason and rule of action, it is reasonable that to those alone a law be given, who know the reason of their action. Now, This applies only to the rational creature. Therefore, it was fitting that a law should be given to the rational creature alone. Further, a law should be given to those in whom is the power to act or not to act. But this belongs to the rational creature alone. Therefore, only the rational creature is adapted to receive a law. Moreover, since a law is nothing else than a reason of action, and the reason for everyone's action is his end, everyone who is capable of receiving a law must receive the law from the one who guides him to his end, even as the inferior craftsman is guided by the master craftsman, and the soldier by the commander-in-chief. Now, the rational creature obtains his last end in God and from God, as we have already shown. Therefore, it was reasonable that a law should be given to men by God. Hence it is said, "I will give my law in their hearts, and I shall write to him my manifold laws." Chapter 115. That the divine law directs man chiefly to God. From this we may gather what is the principal intention of the divine law, for it is evident that every lawgiver intends by his law to direct man to his own end, as the commander-in-chief leads to victory, and the governor of a state, to peace. Now the end intended by God is God himself. Therefore, the chief intention of the divine law is to lead men to God. Again, law, as stated above, is a rule which God's governing providence sets before the rational creature. Now the government of God's providence leads each thing to its proper end. Consequently, the law given by God directs man chiefly to his end. But the end of the human creature is to adhere to God, since in this does his happiness consist, as we have proved above. Therefore, the divine law directs man chiefly to union with God. Also, the intention of every lawgiver is to make those good for whom he legislates. Hence, precepts of law should be about acts of virtue. Therefore, the divine law aims at those acts that are best. Now, of all human acts, the best are those whereby man adheres to God, as being most akin to his end. Therefore, the divine law directs man to these acts before all others. Besides, that which gives a law its force should hold the chief place in the law. But the law given by God derives its force with men, from men being subject to God, for no one is bound by the law of a king whose subject he is not. Therefore, the union of man's mind with God should be the chief thing in the divine law. Hence it is written, "And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee, but that thou fear the Lord thy God, and walk in his ways, and love him, and serve the Lord thy God, with all thy heart, and with all thy soul." Chapter 116. That the end of God's law is the love of God. Since the chief intention of God's law is that man adhere to God, and since man adheres most firmly to God by love, it follows of necessity that the principal purpose of the law is directed to love. It is evident that man adheres to God principally by love. In man there are two things whereby he can adhere to God: his intellect and his will. For by the inferior faculties of his soul he cannot adhere to God, but to lower beings. But the adhesion of the intellect is completed by the adhesion of the will, because by his will man, as it were, rests in that which the intellect apprehends. Now, the will adheres to a thing either by love or by fear, but not in the same way. For when it adheres to a thing through fear, it adheres on account of something else, namely in order to avoid an evil that threatens, unless it adhere to that thing. But when it adheres to a thing through love, it adheres for its own sake. Now, that which is for its own sake is of more account than that which is for another's sake. Therefore, to adhere to God by love is to adhere to him in the closest way possible, and consequently this is the chief intention of the divine law. Again, the end of every, and especially the divine, law is to make men good. Now, man is set to be good because he has a good will, whereby he brings into act whatever good is in him. Also, a will is good through willing the good, and above all the greatest good, which is the end. Therefore, the more his will wills this good, so much the better is the man. Now a man wills more that which he wills on account of love, than that which he wills on account of fear alone. For when he wills a thing only through fear, he is partly unwilling, as when a man, through fear, wills to cast his cargo overboard. Therefore, above all the love of the sovereign good, namely God, makes men good, and is intended by the divine law above all else. Further, man's goodness results from virtue, since it is virtue that makes its possessor good. Hence the law intends to make men virtuous, and the precepts of the law are about acts of virtue. But a condition of virtue is that the virtuous act with both firmness and pleasure. Now, this is especially the effect of love, because through love we do a thing steadfastly and pleasurably. Therefore, love of the good is the ultimate aim of the divine law. Besides, lawgivers move those to whom the law is given by the command of the law which they promulgate. Now, in all things moved by a first mover, the more a thing participates in that movement, and the nearer it approaches to a likeness to that first mover, the more perfectly is it moved. Now God, the divine lawgiver, does all things on account of his love. Consequently, he who tends to him in that way, namely by loving him, tends to him in the most perfect manner. Now, every agent intends perfection in what he does. Therefore, the end of all legislation is that man love God. Hence it is said the end of the commandment is charity, and that the greatest and first commandment in the law is, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God." Hence too, the new law, as being more perfect, is called the law of love, whereas the old law, as being less perfect, is called the law of fear. Chapter 117. That we are directed by the divine law to the love of our neighbor. From this it follows that the divine law aims at the love of our neighbor, for there should be union of affection between those who have one common end. Now, men have one common last end, namely happiness, to which they are directed by God. Therefore, men should be united together by mutual love. Again, whosoever loves a man, loves those whom he loves, and those who are his kindred. Now, men are loved by God, since he prepared for them a last end consisting in the enjoyment of himself. Therefore, as a man is a lover of God, so must he be a lover of his neighbor. Moreover, since man by nature is a social animal, he needs assistance from other men in order to obtain his own end. Now this is most suitably done if men love one another mutually. Hence the law of God, which directs men to their last end, commands us to love one another. Again, in order to apply himself to divine things, man needs calm and peace. Now mutual love, more than aught else, removes the obstacles to peace. Seeing then that the divine law directs men to apply themselves to divine things, we must conclude that this same law leads men to love one another. Further, the divine law is offered to man in aid of the natural law. Now it is natural to all men to love one another, a proof of which is that a man, by a kind of natural instinct, comes to the assistance of anyone even unknown that is in need, for instance by warning him, should he have taken the wrong road, by helping him to rise, should he have fallen, and so forth, as though every man were intimate and friendly with his fellow man. Therefore mutual love is prescribed to man by the divine law. Wherefore it is said, "This is my commandment, that you love one another." And this commandment we have from God, that he who loveth God, love also his brother. And that the second commandment is, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor." Chapter 118. That the divine law binds men to the true faith. From this it is clear that the divine law binds men to the true faith, for just as the beginning of material love is sight exercised through the material eye, so the beginning of spiritual love is the intellectual vision of a spiritual lovable object. Now, the vision of that spiritual lovable object which is God, is impossible to us in the present life except by faith, because it surpasses natural reason, and especially inasmuch as our happiness consists in the enjoyment thereof. Therefore we need to be brought to the true faith by the divine law. Again, the divine law directs man to perfect subjection to God. As man is subject to God as to his will by loving him, so is he subject to him as to his intellect by believing in him. Not indeed by believing anything false, since God, who is truth, cannot propose anything false to man. Wherefore he that believes something false, believes not in God. Therefore the divine law directs man to the true faith. Also, he who errs about something essential to a thing, knows not that thing. Thus if anyone in apprehending an irrational animal were to think it a man, He would not know man. It would be different were he to err about the accidentals of a thing. In composite things, however, he who errs about any of the essential principles, though he know not the thing simply, yet he knows it in some respect. Thus if he thinks a man to be an irrational animal, he knows him in respect of his genus. But this cannot apply to simple things, and any error whatever removes all knowledge of the thing. Now, God is supremely simple. Therefore to err about God, is not to know God. Thus he who believes that God is a body, knows not God at all, but apprehends something else instead of God. Now, a thing is loved and desired according as it is known. Therefore he that errs about God, can neither love God, nor desire him as his end. Consequently, since the aim of the divine law is to make men love and desire God, that law must needs bind men to a true faith in God. Moreover, false opinion in matters of intelligence is like vice opposed to virtue in moral matters, for the true is the good of the intellect. Now, it belongs to the divine law to prohibit vice. Therefore it belongs to it also to prescribe false opinions about God and things divine. Hence it is said without faith it is impossible to please God. Moreover, before other commandments are given, a right faith in God is prescribed when it is said here, O Israel, the Lord thy, 56. God is one. Hereby is refuted the error of those who maintain that it matters not for man's salvation with what faith he serves God. Chapter 119. That our mind is directed to God by certain sensible things. Since it is connatural to man to acquire knowledge through the senses, and since it is most difficult to arise above sensible things, divine providence has appointed sensible things as a reminder to man of things divine, so that thus man's intention might the more readily be recalled to divine things, not excluding the man whose mind is not equal to the contemplation of divine things in themselves. For this reason sensible sacrifices were instituted, since man offers these to God, not because God needs them, but that man might be reminded that he must refer both himself and all that is his to God as his end, and as the Creator, Governor and Lord of all. Again, sensible things are employed for man's sanctification, in the shape of washings, anointings, meat and drink, and the uttering of sensible words, as signifying to man that he receives intelligible gifts from an external source, and from God whose name is expressed by sensible words. Moreover man performs certain sensible actions, not to arouse God, but to arouse himself to things divine, such as prostrations, genuflections, raising of the voice and singing. Such things are not done as though God needed them, for he knows all things, and his will is unchangeable, and he looks at the affection of the heart, and not the mere movement of the body, but we do them for our own sake, that by them our intention may be fixed on God, and our hearts inflamed. At the same time we thereby confess that God is the author of our soul and body, since we employ both soul and body in the worship we give him. Hence we must not wonder that heretics who deny that God is the author of our body, decry the offering of this bodily worship to God, wherein it is clear that they forget that they are men, inasmuch as they deem the presentation of sensible objects to be unnecessary for interior knowledge and affection. For experience shows that by acts of the body the soul is aroused to a certain knowledge or affection. Wherefore it is evidently reasonable that we should employ bodies in order to raise our minds to God. The offering of these bodily things to God is called the worship cultus of God. For we speak of cultivating those things to which we give our thought in the shape of deeds. Now, we give our thought to God in our actions, not indeed that we may be of advantage to him, as when we cultivate other things by our actions, but because by such actions we advance towards God. And since by internal acts we tend to God directly, therefore properly speaking we worship God by internal acts. Nevertheless external acts also belong to the divine worship, forasmuch as by these acts the mind is raised to God. As we have said, this divine worship is also called religion, because by these acts man tethers lag at himself, as it were, lest he stray from God. Also, because by a kind of natural instinct he feels himself obliged in his own way to show reverence to God, from whom flows his being and every good. Wherefore religion is called piety, because by piety we give due honor to those who begot us. Hence it would seem reasonably to belong to piety to honor God the Father of all. For this reason those who are averse to the worship of God are said to be impious. And since not only is God the cause and source of our being, but also our whole being is in his power, and all that we have we owed to him, and because of this he is truly our master, that which we do to honor him is called service. Now, God is Lord not accidentally, as man of his fellow man, but by nature. Hence we owe service to God otherwise than to a fellow man, to whom we are subject accidentally, and who wields over things a restricted dominion, that he receives from God. Wherefore the service due to God is called by the special name of latria by the Greeks. Chapter 120. That the worship of latria is due to God alone. Some there have been who deem that the worship of latria should be given not only to the supreme author of all, but to all things, even creatures, that are above man. Hence some, whilst holding God to be the one universal cause of all, considered that we should offer latria, first after the supreme God, to the heavenly intellectual substances, which they called gods, whether such substances were entirely separate from bodies, or animated the spheres or stars. Secondly, to other intellectual substances which they believed to be united to aerial bodies, and called demons nevertheless, deeming them to be above men, even as an aerial body is above an earthly one. They maintain that these substances should be honored by men with a divine worship, and that in comparison with men they were gods, as being between men and the gods. And as they believed that the souls of good men, through being separated from their bodies, pass to a higher state than that of the present life, they held that divine worship should be given also to the souls of the dead, whom they called heroes or manes. Others, believing God to be the soul of the world, held that divine honor should be given to the whole world and each part thereof, not indeed on account of the body, but on account of the soul, which they said was God, even as we honor a wise man, not for his body but for his soul. Others, again, thought that divine honor should be given even to things which, though beneath man by nature, participate in the power of a higher nature. Wherefore, believing that certain images, made by men, receive a certain supernatural power, either through the influence of a heavenly body, or through the presence of certain spirits, they said that such images should receive divine honor. These images they called gods, for which reason they are called idolaters, because they offered latria to idols, i.e., images. But it is absurd for those who hold that there is but one separate first cause, to give divine honor to another. For we worship God, as stated above, not because he needs it, but that true notions about God may be confirmed in us by means of sensible things. Now, the notion that there is but one supreme God cannot be confirmed in us by means of sensible objects, except by our offering him something distinct, and this we call the divine worship. It is clear, then, that a true notion about the one cause is weakened if divine worship be given to several. Further, as we said above, this external worship is necessary for man in order that his soul be roused to give spiritual homage to God. Now, custom is of great weight in moving the human mind to action, for we are more easily inclined to that which is customary. And the custom among men is that the honor given to the head of the state, for example, the king or the emperor, be given to no other. Therefore the human mind should be urged to realize that there is one supreme cause of all, by rendering to it something that it renders to no other. This is what we call the worship of latria. Again, if the worship of latria were due to a being as superior and not as supreme, since one man, and one angel, is higher than another, it would follow that a man ought to give the worship of latria to another man, and one angel to another angel. And since he who is superior in one respect is inferior in another, the result would be that men would worship one another mutually, which is absurd. Besides, it is customary among men that a special return be due for a special boon. Now, there is a special boon that man receives from the Most High God, namely his creation, for we proved in the second book, that God alone creates. Therefore, man must make to God a special return in recognition of this special boon, and this is the worship of Latria. Moreover, Latria means service, and service is due to a master. Properly and truly, a master is one who orders others to work, and receives orders from none, for he who carries out the orders of another is servant rather than master. Now, God, the supreme cause of all, orders all things to their respective actions, by his providence, as we proved above, wherefore Holy Writ describes the angels and higher bodies as serving both God, whose orders they carry out, and us for whose good they work. Therefore the worship of Latria, which is due to the Sovereign Lord, should be given to none but the supreme cause of all. Also, of all things pertaining to Latria, sacrifice would seem to hold a special place for genuflections, prostrations, and other like signs of honor, may be given even to men, albeit with another intention than when given to God, whereas no one has thought that a sacrifice should be offered except to one whom he looked upon, or pretended to look upon, as God. Now the external sacrifice is a representation of the interior true sacrifice, in which the human mind offers itself to God, and our mind offers itself to God, as the principle of its creation, as the author of its operation, as the end wherein lies its happiness. This can only apply to the supreme cause of all, for it was shown above, that God is the sole cause of the rational soul, that he alone can incline the will of man whithersoever he will, and that man's final happiness consists in the enjoyment of him alone. To God alone, therefore, must man offer sacrifice and the worship of Latria, and not to any spiritual substances whatsoever. Although the opinion which holds that the Most High God is nothing else but the soul of the world, is false, as we have proved, while that is true which holds God to be a separate being, from whom all other intellectual substances, both separate or embodied, originate, yet the offering of Latria to various things is more consistent with the former opinion. Because, by offering the worship of Latria to various things, one would seem to offer the same worship to the one Most High God, to whom, according to this opinion, the various parts of the world are compared, as the various members of the human body are compared to the soul. But reason again is in contradiction with this opinion, for they assert that the worship of Latria should be given to the world not on account of its body but on account of its soul, which they hold to be God. And though the body of the world is divisible into various parts, the soul is indivisible. Therefore divine honor is not to be given to many things, but to one only. Again, if we suppose the world to have a soul that animates the whole and every part thereof, this cannot mean the nutritive or sensitive soul, since the operations of these faculties of the soul are not competent to all the parts of the universe. In fact, granted that the world has a sensitive and nutritive soul, the worship of Latria would not be due to it on account of a like soul, since neither is it due to animals or plants. It follows then that in saying that God, to whom Latria is due, is the soul of the world, they mean the intellectual soul. But this soul is not a perfection of certain definite parts of the body, but in some way regards the whole. This is clearly the case with our soul, which is of lower degree, for the intellect does not employ an organ of the body, as is proved in 3 De Anima, 4. Consequently, according to their principle, divine honor would not have to be shown to the various parts of the world, but to the whole, on account of its soul. Moreover, if, according to their opinion, there is but one soul animating the whole world and all its parts, and if the world is not to be called God save on account of its soul, therefore there will be but one God. Consequently, divine honor is due to one only. And if there be but one soul of the whole, and the various parts again have various souls, they must admit that the souls of the parts are subordinate to the soul of the whole, for the same proportion is between perfections and the things perfected. Now, where there is order among several intellectual substances, the worship of Latria is due only to the one that has the highest place, as we proved against the other opinion. Consequently, the worship of Latria would have to be given, not to the parts of the world, but to the whole alone. Again, it is evident that certain parts of the world have no soul of their own, consequently worship would not have to be given to them. Yet these people worshipped all the elements of the world, namely earth, water, fire and other like inanimate bodies. Besides, it is clear that a superior does not owe the worship of Latria to an inferior. Now man, in the order of nature, is superior to all inferior bodies, at least, according as he has a more perfect form. Therefore man would not have to give the worship of Latria to inferior bodies, if such worship were due to them by reason of their own souls. The statement that each part of the world has its own soul, and that the whole world has not one common soul, leads to the same inconsistencies. For it would follow that the highest part of the world has the highest kind of soul, to which alone, according to what we have said, the worship of Latria would be due. These opinions are surpassed in unreasonableness by the one which states that the worship of Latria is to be given to images. For if these images derive power or excellence from the heavenly bodies, this is no reason for giving them the worship of Latria, since it is not given those bodies themselves, except perhaps on account of their souls, as some have asserted. And these images are supposed to receive a certain power from the heavenly bodies in respect of their bodily power. Besides, it is clear that they do not receive from the heavenly bodies a perfection equal to the human soul. Therefore they are inferior in excellence to any individual man. Consequently man does not owe them any kind of worship. Again, the cause is more potent than the effect. Now, men are the makers of these images. Therefore man owes them no worship. And if it be said that these images derive power or excellence through association with some spiritual substance, this again is insufficient, for the worship of Latria is due to no spiritual substance except only to the highest of all. Moreover, the rational soul is associated in a more excellent way with the human body than a spiritual substance with the aforesaid images. Therefore man still remains in a position of greater excellence than those images. Again, as these images are sometimes made for producing baneful effects, it is clear that if such effects are brought about by spiritual substances, those spiritual substances are wicked. This is still more clear from the fact that they are deceitful in their answers, and demand of their worshippers things that are contrary to virtue. Hence they are inferior to good men, and consequently the worship of Latria is not due to them. It is therefore evident from what has been said that the worship of Latria is due to the one most high God alone. Hence it is said, he that sacrificeth to the God shall be put to death, save only to the Lord, and the Lord thy God shalt thou adore, and him only shalt thou serve. Again it is said of heathens professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into the likeness of the image of a corruptible man, and of birds, and of four-footed beasts, and of creeping things, and further on, who changed the truth of God into a lion, worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is above all things God, blessed forever. Since then it is wrong to give the worship of Latria to any other but the first principle of all, and to incite to do wrong belongs only to an ill-disposed rational creature, it is clear that men were urged to the aforesaid unlawful forms of worship, at the instigation of the demons, who coveting divine honor even offered themselves to man's worship in the place of God. Hence it is said, all the gods of the Gentiles are devils, and the things which the heathen sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils, and not to God. Wherefore, since the principal intention of the divine law is that man be subject to God, and give him a peculiar reverence not only in thought, but also in word and deeds of the body, hence, first of all, when God's law is set forth, the worship of more than one God is forbidden, where it is said, thou shalt not have strange gods before me, thou shalt not make to thyself a graven thing, nor the likeness of anything. Secondly, man is forbidden to utter irreverently the name of God, in order, to wit, to confirm a falsehood, and this is expressed in the words, thou shalt not take the name of God in vain. Thirdly, a certain time is prescribed for rest from external works, in order that the mind may have leisure to think of God. Hence it is said, remember that thou keep holy the Sabbath day.